Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 6 of our Mental Health Awareness Week specials. It's also the final one of our series, and a slightly weird and different one, because myself and Will are talking about ourselves and our own battles with mental health. But first off, hello to you over on the phone, because it's the middle of the week and we couldn't actually meet up in person. So how are you all the way on the other side of London?
Yeah, I'm good. Slightly nervous about doing this because I've never really spoken about it that much. Well, I've never spoken about it in public before, and probably some of the stuff I'll come out with is stuff I've not said before. So it'll be an interesting debate, but it will be good, and hopefully it will educate. And if it helps one person, then that's all that matters, really.
Yeah, that's kind of the target. And if it's any consolation, a little nervous for myself as well, and a little apprehensive because it's something I've only ever written about on one occasion, and on that occasion it took me 3 months to actually send it to someone. And we're talking about a year in the past now since I actually did that. So this is very loose, we're kind of winging this entire episode, but we've kind of got it structured into two sections. The first section is kind of what we had and why, and then the second section is more about the help we received and our recovery aspect. So we'll kick off with what we had and why, and put some bare bones on this and a little bit of background. And I suppose we'll kick off with you then. If you kind of want to take us through the trigger, if you like, and what it was you actually experienced.
I mean, my story is a strange one. So when I was 20, I was diagnosed with severe generalized anxiety and depression, which was the anxiety wasn't necessarily a surprise, but the depression was. And the only reason I went to a doctor was because I had two good friends from cheer who sort of sat down, took the time to sit down and speak to me. Ironically, I was supposed to be speaking to them about relationship issues they were having, but the conversation ended up being about me. And they just sort of made me realise that the way I was thinking and the way I was acting was a bit odd. So I went to the doctors, and then, you know, subsequently got told, you know, what he thought was wrong with me, and then I went to a counsellor, and she agreed, and yeah, it was really weird. But now looking back, it was obvious at the time that I'd been suffering with both for a long time. So I mean, you could link my anxiety going all the way back to very early childhood. So I had a difficult birth, and around my head getting stuck and stuff like that. And then even as a child, apparently I used to have like big fits where when it came to bath time, I didn't like people touching my head. Then at sort of the age of 7, I started having panic attacks, largely to do with food and just feeling a bit weird and a bit different to normal. And it got to the point where I was sort of between the ages of 9 and 11, where I would have a hot meal, then I'd have to go to the toilet and, you know, have a panic attack in there and sort of have to sit in there and calm down. And that was happening after every meal. And actually got taken to the doctors by my mum because she thought I might have some form of eating disorder, but sort of grew out of that. But the panic attacks kept coming, and then yeah, I think the depression probably started when, for the first time, when I was 11, when I missed secondary school. And I don't really remember this because I've clearly jumped out of my memory, but my mum used to say that before every day before school, I'd come down, I'd be crying my eyes out. I had black rings under my eyes, but I'd not really been sleeping, and I got so worked up. And then I'd have sort of spells of depression between the ages of 11 and 21, really. The worst it got was during my first year at university. So I would just come off the really strong acne drug, Roaccutane, which is known and one of its side effects is being causing anxiety and depression, especially in young men. Mm-hmm. Initially, my mum and I were worried about me going on it, but obviously neither of us really realised what was going on in my head. So I went on it, and it was fine when I was on it. It was when I came off that things started getting bad. And the first time at university, I was sharing a room, but in second term, I was on my own, and that's when things got really bad, when I came off the drug. And I just locked myself in my room. And I remember I was doing a drama production called Thoroughly Modern Millie. And the day after it finished, I was downstairs in the bar. And it was some like charity quiz night, and they were doing a version of Take Me Out, and I just started crying, and I didn't even know why I was crying. Like, I tried so hard to stop, but it was just all a bit weird, and I went home that weekend and was just burst into tears with my parents, which is rare for me because I don't really cry. And then sort of managed to work my way out of that, but never really thought anything was wrong. Obviously, now looking back, it was so obvious. I was so low, but at the time, I just sort of got on with it, and I just thought it was homesickness, and I'd grow out of it. And things did get better, but you know, only after really a lot of cognitive behaviour therapy. Yeah. And then I can only really say that I fully got out of a depressive state after I'd left university, because I had a lot of things going on in third year. I struggled to cope with my diagnosis. I had other things going on. So it was actually that break from university, as much as I loved it, that sort of set me on the straight and narrow. Yeah. So that's a very long-winded of my struggles.
Well, I mean, you said like a couple of times that it was kind of obvious looking back at it now. So I'm kind of thinking, when you're having that original chat with your friends from Cheer, what was it they noticed that kind of flipped that chat away from them and onto you?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know on both occasions how the conversation got onto me rather than them. But I remember one of the things that stuck out was a girl called Becca. She said, you know, you're always on edge. No one can relax around you. And I was a bit like, what do you mean? She said, we're always so anxious that we can't relax around you. You're always on edge. You know, we can't always tell if you're actually listening to us. And I thought I was quite chilled and laid back, but clearly not. And then I remember the other girl, Casey Hanley, who was just walking around Durham with her. And I don't know why, but we ended up talking about me again. She was like, we were just saying stuff. And then I was probably just putting myself down quite a bit. She's like, well, you don't have to put yourself down. There's so many people out there who like you. You know, you don't realise that, and you need to realise that. And sort of, she was trying to big me up, and then I realised that actually it's become quite a big habit of mine to just naturally put myself down. And I've never had really any self-confidence since the age of about 10 or 11 when I first started really suffering with my mental health, although I didn't realise it at the time. I went from being massively confident, slightly arrogant, sort of 10, 11-year-old to this really shy, humble kid with no confidence. Even now, I do still struggle with self-confidence quite a bit, even at work, you know, surrounded by my colleagues. Sometimes I'm really shy and really nervous to go up to the athletes, especially, and just say hello, because, you know, I still look at them and think, why would they want to interact with me, you know, when in reality they are not really any different to me. A lot of them are a very similar age. And, you know, when you do interact with them, it's always positive. It's always polite. They're always really, you know, inquisitive about me and asking how I am and everything. So just, yeah, those two instances are sort of within a week of each other as well, pretty much. And were a bit of a turning point, and that's then when I sort of wanted to seek help.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting that people pointed out that you had this edgy, kind of anxious feel about you that was sort of emanating to other people. Clearly you didn't realise that yourself.
No, I had no idea what was going on. Honestly, it's ridiculous, because I look back and, you know, some of the symptoms are so obvious. You know, the panic attacks before and sometimes after, or, you know, both every single meal, and, you know, getting worked up in certain situations and, you know, stopping myself from doing things, actually stopping it makes anxiety worse, and then it's just like this downward spiral, and then, you know, the self-loathing and hatred and, you know, the general periods of feeling down and really negative. And, you know, there were suicidal thoughts, but even then, I just thought that was normal and that's what everyone did. Yeah, it's just one of those things that it became so normalised to me so quickly that I just assumed that everyone did it. And I was, you know, why should I be classified as suffering with a mental health issue? There's nothing special about me, you know. There's people out there in so much worse situations. I've got a fantastic family. I have, you know, a good group of friends. I'm in a first world country, you know, I'm not poor, I'm in a, you know, stable background. So why should I be suffering with things like that?
Yeah, was there a lot of, or did that build up into a lot of pent up anger, if you like, and you had to kind of release that in some ways?
Oh yeah, I've always been, I wouldn't say quick to fly off the hook. I mean,
I have a short fuse and I do get angry and stroppy quite quickly, but I've never really turned it into physical violence. But I think one way in which my anger really, really came out was when I played cricket. So I used to, obviously, for so many years, I wanted to play cricket professionally, and I put so much pressure on myself before every innings. You know, I get so, so nervous, and we struggled for quite a while to find a way of calming me down before I went out, because it was just affecting my game so badly. I get so nervous and so worked up, and then I get out for a low score, and you know, it was very detrimental. And then if I did get out for a low score, and most of the time when I get out in cricket, it's not because I've been done by a good ball, it's because I've made an error myself.
Through frustration.
I'd just come out and I'd just unleash hell on my equipment. I never threw my bat that I can remember, but I'd throw my helmet, but I'd had to be whacked against the wall, my gloves would go flying. You know, I'd end up punching my kit bag or punching the, you know, in some cases punching a wall or something like that. It was a way of self-harm in terms of I just wanted to hurt myself so badly. And, you know, this didn't just happen in cricket, but I know there was quite a few, instances when I used to learn playing the clarinet and I'd make a mistake and I'd end up biting my fingers. And, you know, I got really thick skin because of this genetic condition I have, which means I don't bruise very easily. So, you know, I could get away with biting my fingers and no one noticing. I'd end up punching things. I'd end up, you know, slapping my legs or banging my fist against the wall. Or, you know, sometimes I was sitting on the toilet and I'd just spontaneously get angry at myself for something. And then whack the sink so hard it hurt. And for me, that was just the release of all the tension. You know, these massive fits of anger. And I actually enjoyed hurting myself. But at the time, I never realised, you know, that was anything wrong. And that actual release of hitting something and the pain would just make all the tension just dissipate. And I just feel like this tired, sort of nervous wreck afterwards. But the anger had gone. It's just a really, really weird cycle. And, yeah, people used to laugh and joke at cricket about, you know, how I do this. And I must have looked ridiculous, but for me it was the only way of getting out that anger, because otherwise it would have just built up and would have come out in other ways, which, you know, I might have gone home and taken it out on my mum, my dad and my sister, which wasn't fair. So sort of, even though most of it was subconscious, I was sort of subconsciously, you know, getting rid of my anger as soon as I possibly could stop it from building up. But it, in a lot of ways, it either involved damaging equipment or it involved damaging myself, yeah, which was obviously not healthy. And it's something I only really realised about 6 months ago. So I'd spoken to my therapist about it, and then I realised that, you know, actually in recent times I've stopped doing that. You know, if I do get angry or frustrated, I don't ever go and, you know, I don't bite myself, I don't punch myself, I don't slap myself in the head, I don't go and hit things. There are sometimes I premeditate. I'd be in such a foul mood about something, I'd premeditate coming home and laying into my wardrobe, which I did a couple of times at Union. On one occasion I really, really badly hurt my knuckle. It wasn't the same for about a year after that, which sort of helped and stopped me from doing it again. But yeah, it sounds ridiculous. Like, the more I say it, the more ridiculous it sounds, but that was sort of what was going or not going through my head.
It's quite a different kind of contrast, because if we look back at like Ruth's episode and then Chloe's episode as well, and they've obviously both self-harmed, but that was in a way so that they could feel something. But yours is very much a way of trying to get all that frustration and anger out of your body, kind of thing. But
yeah, it was a punishment and a release of the anger at the same time.
Yeah, and I'm also kind of that aspect when you say everyone, like when you're on the cricket pitch and you take it out on the equipment, and everyone's kind of kicking back and laughing at you because you're kind of the sideshow, if you like. That must just add to whatever is going on in your mind.
At the time, I didn't really think I'd noticed it, but I must have done it. Cricket is one of these really weird sports in that, by definition, it's a team sport, but it's also so incredibly individual. Like, it relies so heavily on individual performances in a team sport. So it's a really weird paradox, and it's quite easy, you know, to feel segregated and singled out, and after sort of leaving cold cricket from sort of under 16s onwards, I've never really felt like part of a team up until I joined my youth club recently, because I felt the club I was at, I was, you know, you didn't know who you were playing with a lot of the time, and then, you know, sometimes you're playing with guys who didn't really have any respect for you, and sometimes you're playing with sort of older guys who would shout at you if you make a mistake, and it was like it didn't really fit in anywhere. And then that, you know, when you only had people looking at you and seeing what you were doing, there was only ever one person who actually took the time and wasn't laughing at me, and he actually took the time. And I remember Bob took me on a walk around. I got out for about 2 at Cobham. We just went for a walk around the pitch, and he just started talking to me, saying, you know, you shouldn't do this. People are saying this about you, and people are saying that. And this was maybe when I was about 17, 18. And it was at that point I sort of made a conscious decision that I would try not to, you know, react like that. And that's because he'd actually taken the time to, you know, sit with me and just say, you know, cricket isn't the be-all and end-all, you know, there's other things going on. He hadn't realised what was going on in my head, but he'd realised, you know, there was a problem, and he took me to one side and we had a chat, and then things did get better after then. And that was, you know, 2 years before I even realised there was something wrong.
Saying this as someone who's obviously outside of cricket and looking in, because I've never played the sport in my life, is the culture kind of about the individual rather than the team? Or is that just overgeneralising it in every single way possible?
No, it isn't. There's a lot of egos in cricket, especially club cricket. Obviously, I don't really know what it's like at the top levels, but there's a lot of, it's a lot about, you know, protecting your ego. And even if, you know, there's a lot of players, you're playing with your close mates, you know, you still want to beat them, you still want to be the best, you still want to be seen as the player that the team relies on. But there's also a culture of brown nosing expected in certain clubs as well. And if you don't, you know, I made the decision that I didn't want to brown nose at 2 or 3 clubs I've been at. And you almost get punished for that, because I just wanted to turn up and play cricket with a decent bunch of people. I didn't want to have to do all these stupid, you know, initiations and drinking games in the bars. And I didn't want to, you know, be part of their silly jokes and be picked on and stuff like that.
And then, like, in the notes you fired towards me before we started this, you mentioned a running addiction as well. And I wonder, did that come after the cricket aspect, in that you wanted something to feel active with? But then you also mentioned the addictive side of it. And why did it become such an addiction to you?
Well, the running addiction was a weird one. So it was in my 3rd year at uni. This is probably something we'll touch on a bit more later, but I was in our sort of second thing, but I was doing my cheer at the time, and I was having views personally. I was struggling to sort of come to terms with my initial diagnosis. My therapy at the time wasn't going very well, because it was being done over the phone, and I don't normally react well to things like that. And then I took on this challenge as part of November, the Mow and Move challenge, the growing on the start and doing something. And at the time, I sort of had my first attempt at a relationship, which hadn't ended the way I wanted it to end. It wasn't a relationship, it was just sort of things and what was about 2 weeks and 5 days. Hadn't gone the way I wanted it. That was the first time I'd ever experienced anything like that. It obviously had gone wrong. And I was struggling to cope, so I'd taken up this challenge to run 150 kilometres a month. This is on top of all my cheer, which I was doing 4 times a week, and before my university. And initially it was great, because I was going out, I was running, and I was, you know, I was feeling good. I was listening to my music, I was getting pumped up, I was doing some really good runs, I was running in the rain, which always spurs me on and makes me run better, and everything was going really well. And then with about a week left, I got a stress fracture in my foot because I'd overdone it, and I had to stop running immediately. And it was then I realised I got addicted, because I was then grumpy and really miserable, and no one could sort of get me out of this really down state I was in. And I was also very angry and frustrated with the world. And what I'd realised was I'd used running sort of as an emotional outlet, you know, to go and pound the pavement, sort of get rid of that anger and that frustration. And now I wasn't able to do that, and I was being a bit cooped up because I had this, you know, stress fracture on my foot, and it was... And that put me in an even worse place. And then with everything else going on as well, that was a tough time to get through.
That kind of puts you at square one again as well.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'd been having this sort of initial CBT treatment. It wasn't going very well. And one thing also about me is that I refused any drugs. So I've come through sort of my mental health stuff without taking any sort of medication because of the way I reacted to the relaxing pain. I don't like taking drugs unless I absolutely have to. So I got over the addiction fairly quickly. Which was good because I'd only been running for three and a half weeks, so it wasn't too major. And then things started looking up after Christmas. Obviously, with the longer days as well, that's always something that's helped me. So
yeah,
but yes, running was a bit of a probably wasn't the best idea for several reasons at the time. I mean, most of my cheer friends would say the stress fracture was probably the reason it wasn't a good idea, but also for me, it was the the fact that I got addicted to it, and I know I've got an addictive personality, and it was stupid of me to do it, but hey-ho.
Yeah, because obviously the next logical point is to move on to the recovery aspect of you, but there's my stuff that we have to go through, which is some similarity in you in that it kind of stems from childhood, in that I was never the loudest person in the world. I was usually the quietest person in the room. Still am now, to an extent. I'm not exactly the most outgoing person in the world. And I always remember that was always the main criticism my teachers had at me at parents' evenings and things like that. It was like, everything else is fine, but he needs to talk more. And that was the overarching criticism about me. And I always took that to heart for some reason. And I always felt that was why... That was my biggest problem. So I now went to university, and again, similar to you, in that I had a relationship which did not end well, and that messed up my head entirely. And that was my third year at uni, where it all came to a head, really, in that I blamed myself for a lot of what had happened then. Got depressed, suffered severe anxiety, and I effectively cut myself off from everyone. So I stopped going to class, I stopped going to any form of extracurricular stuff that I was doing at uni. Obviously, people know I fenced a lot when I was a kid, and I continued to fence when I was at university, but then I stopped doing that, and just cut myself off from everyone. Ended up putting on a lot of weight through comfort eating as well. And because I stopped going to anything, and that includes my university classes, I failed my third year, which is why I'm always still a little bit embarrassed when people ask me, oh, why were you at university for 5 years? Part of it is that I did a master's, but so it should have taken me 4 years. But the other half is that I failed a year, essentially, because not because my exam results were bad, but because I stopped going to class. And that is the only reason I failed that year. And it took me until the end of that year before I actually admitted it to someone. And that was my parents, because when the big F for fail comes in on your module, you've kind of got to explain that to them. And that was probably one of the hardest conversations I've ever had, was to actually tell them why I'd stopped going to class. And I hope they don't mind me saying this either, because they're probably listening. But I don't think they handled it in the best way possible, because they thought it was a purely academic thing and that I just didn't want to be at uni, and it was just me sacking off my classes because I was lazy, kind of thing. And then I had a proper breakdown. I started crying and all sorts, and they eventually told me to go to see a GP. And I went to the GP, someone who I didn't really connect with either. I always felt he was a little bit patronising in the way he questioned me. But I was diagnosed with depression, and I was subscribed antidepressants as well. And then went to the university counselling service too, and basically had weekly sessions with them to try and sort my head out and try and get to the crux of the problem. And I don't know if you had this either, when you went to the counselling service for the first time, they make you fill out a form with kind of little boxes next to all these questions ranked from number one to number four. So the questions like, oh, how are you feeling today? Have you felt anything suicidal in the last week? Do you feel like you can speak to someone comfortably? And depending on the box that you tick, they added up your score. And if you were over a certain number, that meant you were in the in need of counselling threshold, if you like. So I ended up talking to counsellors for a good long while, and then also had to lodge an appeal with the university during that time so that I wouldn't get kicked out, essentially. And kudos to the university in that they did take my claim seriously. Had to obviously provide a lot of evidence, including a letter describing in detail everything that had happened to me, both with my mental health and also the stuff in my relationship that had triggered that, which was probably and still remains the hardest thing I've ever had to write in my life. But they did let me repeat the year with no penalties whatsoever, hence why I was there for 5 years. And yeah, it's an incredibly weird feeling having that going on in your head, because you just walk around town, for example, and you're totally zoned out. You just don't notice stuff that you would on a day-to-day basis. Just random people walking across the road, things like that. You're just in your own little bubble, and it's very hard to get out of that, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, I think it's different for everyone. So I've been through different... I can remember about probably 5 or 6 depressive episodes, and each one has been different for me. So I've had the really, really low one that in my first year at university. I had the manic one in my third year at university. I've had the in-between one. So you were saying there about how, you know, on reflection, you know that you were acting differently. And I know, you know, from when I was going through my really bad states that I was acting differently, but at the time it felt normal to me, even though it was completely not normal. Was that something similar that you felt as well, that even though now you can see you were acting differently, at the time you didn't really notice what was going on, or for you was it a bit more noticeable?
Kind of yes, in that I did notice it, and noticed stuff wasn't right in my head. Not originally at first, but probably, I don't know, halfway through that year, when I realised I'm not going to any classes, I'm not actually going out to see people. That's probably when I noticed stuff isn't right. But because I'm such a naturally reserved kind of person, and I really don't like talking about myself, I didn't want to tell anyone, and I didn't want to admit it to myself as well. 'Cause kind of admitting it to myself would prove to me that I'd failed in some way. I don't know if I was trying to find some other way to try and fix things and make things work. But I think the overriding feature of my personality, i.e. the lack of self-confidence that I'd always carried through school, and the quietness, and the not really feeling comfortable to talk about anything to people, that kind of overrid all the sensible voices in my head saying, tell someone now, tell someone there's a problem.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic you put in. And so that, obviously that relationship and that trigger that you had in your university experience, was that the first time you'd ever experienced something like that? Or with hindsight, was it perhaps, you know, not the first time, but maybe the most serious of times?
Hard to say. I think, obviously, it was by far and away the most serious thing I've ever had to go through. But as I kind of went through the recovery stage, I noticed that there's elements here and there that I've probably carried with me throughout the entirety of my school life, but never addressed, because I just thought it was me, and I was, a bit of an oddball maybe, in that. Because I was associated myself with a lot of loud and bubbly people, because I like being amongst that kind of company where I can just kind of sit and spectate and chip in every so often. And I just thought,
totally,
you know, yeah, I'm just the quiet one in the group. Fine, I can deal with that. But then, yeah, when you actually look back at it upon reflection, you see a lot of things that weren't quite right there, but I never acknowledged they were right, and therefore never actually thought about trying to improve them and things like that. Even stuff like small talk. I used to be one of the things I hated most in this world, is meeting someone new and having to make small talk about anything, because I found that the hardest thing in the world to do. But now, obviously, when I realise that's an issue, I've taken steps to try and tackle that.
I mean, I still try and avoid it at all costs. Yeah. And you mentioned that you're fencing, so you said how you stopped going to class and everything, but you kept going back to fencing. I was just wondering, you know, what was it about the sport that, you know, meant you kept going back and you didn't give up on that, whereas maybe you gave up on some other stuff?
It's a weird one, because I kept fencing for a little bit, but then I stopped going to training kind of halfway through the year, and I flat out stopped going to any of the socials that we had. But it's a totally different sport to a lot of sports in that it's an individual sport. It does have a team aspect, but it's a totally separate competition. It's primarily about you and your own performance. And that's partly why I took it up in the first place in school when I was 12. So I was all about football before that, primarily because of my dad's influence. And as well as me being a terrible footballer, I kind of felt I would let the team down by being a terrible footballer. But also, if I was maybe one of the better performing players that day, then other people were letting me down. So I wanted to find a sport where I'd get the reward that I got from putting as much work in as I could. And it was one of those things. I went along to fencing when I was 12, found out I was quite good at it, and then ended up doing really, really well because I put in a lot of work into that. I would train 6 days a week when I was at school, and that's ultimately why I ended up fencing for Britain in my youth. And then I continued that at uni, and I kind of kept going to start with because it is primarily an individual sport. You can just rock up with your bag, get your kit on, grab a sword, and then hit someone with it. And the same way with you looking for that release, the fact that you get to hit someone legally with a sword is actually quite a good stress release in a lot of regards. And I think a lot of people, it's obviously a wide spectrum of people that do fencing, but a lot of people kind of turn to it for that aspect. There's a few people, I don't know if you want to classify them as your general, I don't know, Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones fans, it's a legit way of actually getting to own some swords and wave them around in a safe environment. And it is quite therapeutic in a weird sort of way when you actually get to beat someone with a sword and win your match quite comfortably. But then, as that year went on, having to face people and talk to them and try and explain why I hadn't gone to the most recent social event, for example, or why I stopped going to the pub after training, because we always did that every night as well, and that became way too much of a chore, so I just kind of withdrew entirely. And if you look back at some of the Facebook photos of me of that time, where I went to the fencing fundraiser night, and that was the first time I think I'd seen any of them for about 2 or 3 months, and I look horrendous. I mean, I look incredibly awkward, and I've put on about 4 or 5 stone in weight in that time.
So you've mentioned there about the wins in fencing and how it felt good to beat people, but even maybe before the mental health and the depression became a really big thing, would you react in a similar way to losses as I would when I got out in cricket, or were you a lot more calm and reserved?
Originally, before I went to uni, it was more calm and reserved. And I say that because I was very fortunate in that the club that was at my school was one of the best clubs in the country. And we had a lot of good competitive fencers there, which was great for me to train against and improve, and probably why I ended up where I ended up in terms of getting results and things. But because everyone was so good and so confident with it, I always felt, and again, because of my personality, I always felt a little bit of an outsider in that club. So naturally, I kind of just kept everything in and restrained myself. But it would be different during a competition. If because they're kind of different. You spend your entire day doing one competition. So you do each round, you do your group stage, and then your last 32, your last 16, and so on, depending on how many people are there, all in one day. And I always remember my best competitions, my best competition results, always came when, for some reason, I got properly into it and got a bit fired up. Not in terms of like chucking stuff around when I got angry, but like if I won a point, for example, bearing in mind each fight is to 15, so that's quite a lot of points, you know, you'd be shouting and you're roaring your success, which I kind of picked up from watching other people doing the exact same thing. So I kind of put on this weird competitive alter ego during competitions. Don't know what it was about competitive action that kind of brought it out on me. But then once it's back to training in normal life, you kind of rein it in a bit again. But then when I went to uni, club, totally different vibe. Not that I want to take away the success of some of the people there, because there were plenty of good fencers there, but it was more of a university club rather than a competitive club. It was more about meeting people and having fun, and that's why I preferred that club. That's why pretty much all my friends from uni that I still see now are from that club. But in terms of me throwing things around and stuff, I lost that edge to me in competition because I felt more chill and I didn't feel as pressured while training. And there's only been a couple of occasions while I was in Scotland where I actually went to a competition and got fired up, and those were the two best competition results I ever got. So it was kind of weird how that it took that edge away from me, but at the same time I felt more comfortable with those people, maybe because they were more like-minded or what, and maybe I felt I could relate to them a little bit more.
You mentioned them there, and sort of move the conversation, and I know I've always found it difficult to maintain and establish close relationships, but when I do, especially recently, I find that it's really helpful. And for you, were those friends sort of a really good sort of buffer and safety net to help you through some of the tough times, and then, you know, help you get back to a healthy, you know, happy lifestyle?
Yeah, 100%. It's why, I mean, I'm speaking to you now, like 3 days after I've just come back from Scotland to see a lot of them. So when I did my third year part two, if you like, because I effectively had to repeat a year, so all the people I was in classes with, they're in their fourth year. So I'm now in classes with a bunch of people I've never met before in my life. So the only people I kind of knew and knew I could turn to all the time was the fencing club. So I went about ingraining myself in that club as much as possible, be it on a social aspect, but also a committee aspect as well. Like I ended up becoming armourer that year so I could get more involved, and then I got men's captain the year after. But yeah, that's kind of what it was. And ingraining myself in that club and then finding that these guys weren't just going to be teammates of mine, they were actually some of my best friends. I attribute that hugely to kind of my recovery and helping me through, because if I hadn't had that, then a lot of my university time would have been just about miserable things rather than anything positive. So a lot of the happy memories, and primarily the main reasons I still go back up there, because I mean I love that city and I love that country, is primarily because of them. And I still obviously stay in contact with them now. And it was about having fun and using sport, not just as a competitive thing, but something to actually build relationships with. Because like you say, I find it hard to build close relationships with people who are new. But somehow when you're in that environment, it just kind of happens. And there's very little effort on my part, on their part, to actually get close. And then that sticks with you once you've finished your university degree as well.
And were they actively, you know, were they realising, you know, this guy is suffering, I'm going to help him, or was it just, you know, they were just wanting to be your mates, and the recovery and the getting better just came as part of developing them?
First, I never told anyone why I'd failed my year and what I was going through. And this is something that we've probably alluded to a fair bit on all the episodes we've done so far, in that I was very ashamed of it. And it actually, I only started opening up when me and one of my good friends got together and we became a couple. And it's, a lot of the stuff she did for me helped me to open up and talk about that sort of stuff, which is kind of the key message we're always putting across now, and how important it is to actually admit that you're not okay, and that it's okay to say you're not okay. And as soon as I started telling them for the first time, suddenly that's kind of when the penny dropped, and they went, oh, that this explains a whole great deal of why you weren't around then. And then it becomes a whole lot more understanding, and then almost like a family kind of thing. Not in that they specifically help me, everyone else, by giving me pointers here and there, but just knowing that they understood, and that they were there just being my mates, and that I knew that they were okay with my history, if you like. That just kind of made the world of good to me.
It must have been, you know, incredibly helpful. And I know for me, my memories of university are tainted because I didn't actually get better until after I'd left. But for you, that must, you know, as you've alluded to already, that must have actually allowed you to enjoy sort of your final year or so there. And that's why you love coming back.
My final 2 years were by far and away the best 2 years, even with dissertations and all sorts of stuff like that. And obviously that's mainly down to the fencing lot, but it's also down to an organisation I joined called Youth Football Scotland, who I joined them as a volunteer reporter. And this is why when people ask me now, like, if ever I have a spare moment, I'm always doing more work, which is probably not great for my social life. And people are always saying to me, you're always working, you're always working, you're always working. But a large part of that is down to that YFS aspect, in that I became a volunteer football reporter, which inadvertently led to the career that you and I are both doing now. By doing that, gained a lot of self-confidence, and I also found my purpose in life, if that doesn't sound too high and mighty. In that, not only did I obviously enjoyed football and I loved reporting on it, and then I soon discovered that this is really what I wanted to do, is to be a sports reporter, but it also was a way of forcing me into an environment that I found uncomfortable. So going along and watching a game, fine, write about it, fine. But it was the get some quotes afterwards that I was very apprehensive about when I initially applied. And once you do it for the first 1-2 months, you're completely bricking it every time you walk up to this strange person. Here I am, this weird little English kid, rocking up in some of the most interesting places, if that's the polite way of saying it, in Dundee, asking who these guys, effectively just dads of the kids that are playing, what their thoughts are on the match. And I found that incredibly nervous. But somehow, through the strength I've managed to build up, through all the other bits and bobs, forced myself to do that. It's obviously led to the career I'm doing now, but a large part of me being a reporter now is that I continuously, for the sake of my job, otherwise I'll be fired, have to force myself into positions that I'm uncomfortable with. A little bit like you were saying earlier, like, I'm naturally reserved, so sometimes at work when I'm talking to my work colleagues, I'm the quiet one. I like to sit back and sometimes just observe. But then when something happens, if there's been a car crash and I actually have to go out and talk to people, or one recently where someone was found dead in a pond and I had to go around asking, or door knocking people and asking what they'd heard and things like that. Go back to 3 years ago. There's no way in hell I'd be doing that. Like, it wouldn't even come across my mind. It's still an incredibly uncomfortable thing too, to do right now. But a large part of why I continuously work, even when I'm not supposed to be on, is that I need to force myself all the time to do things that I'm uncomfortable with, otherwise I feel like I'm taking a step back. It's always about trying to keep pushing it and trying to make sure I don't revert to how I was. Not that it was a bad thing, because I think a lot of the stuff that I had to realise was also to accept myself for who I am, and that being the quiet, reserved person isn't actually a bad thing. It kind of, it's actually quite a useful thing to have someone in this world where there's probably too many voices and too many opinions floating around shouting at each other on political debates or whatever it may be. It probably actually helps that there is someone to take a look back and look at something without much of an opinion going on in their head, so they can make an informed judgment. And that's kind of how I see my role now, be it me as a person and also be it me as a reporter. So kind of two key things: pushing myself to always do uncomfortable things, and also accepting myself for the personality that I had, and that it's not necessarily a bad thing. The thing I had issue with was accepting that it wasn't a bad thing. So I don't know if that's, if those have come into play in your own recovery as well, kind of that accepting exception that it's okay to be the way you are.
Well, in that sort of in that period where you were talking, there two things sprang to mind. So the first thing was you were talking about putting yourself in an uncomfortable situation, and I just thought back to when we both worked at Crufts last year.
What a
when we had to, it was certainly an experience. And when each night they did the best of breeds, and we'd have to come out and we'd have to interview, you know, each of the top four or whatever it was, and what category. And I felt so uncomfortable doing that. And I'd previously been in situations where I'd had to, you know, go up to people and ask questions when I wasn't, you know, entirely happy, but I'd forced myself to do it. But that was a real, I think, turning point for me in my journalism career, was that, you know, we had to do it. There was no choice. And I was so terrified at the start, but by the end of it, you know, after 4 days where you've interviewed 100 people or something ridiculous like that, you're just into the flow of it, and that, massively helped. And, you know, whenever I do get nervous, you know, if I have to go and approach one of our players or something like that, I actually then remember, well, our players know who I am, like, they'll be willing to talk, whereas, you know, these people at Crufts didn't have a clue who I was, half of them weren't willing to talk, but, you know, that couldn't have been worse than that. And the second thing that came to mind was when you were talking about, you know, accepting yourself for who you are. And when I had my first attempt at a relationship, and it broke down, and it didn't break down, it didn't go anywhere. One of the reasons it didn't go anywhere was she turned around and said something along the lines of, how can you expect someone to like you when you don't like yourself? I don't think it was quite that cold, but it was something along those lines, and it really made me think. So I've been questioning for so many years, like, what is it about me that's so unattractive that no one has ever been interested in me? Because apart from, you know, one or two, you know, school kid crushes, I'd never been aware of anyone being interested in me until this girl, and I was, you know, 20 at this point, and, you know, that was my first kiss and everything. And that sort of dawned on me then, that I realised, you know, perhaps that's why, because if you've got no self-confidence, then people, why would someone be attracted to you? And I think she made a very good point there, and it's something that I've tried to work on with limited success. You know, my self-confidence is still quite low, and I'm still very much single, but it's, you know, it was just a very, and on a difficult evening for me, that was probably the best thing that happened and that she said, and that's something that just has really resonated with me. And, you know, it's something that when I am feeling a bit crap and I think of that moment, I think, well, actually, I might not be 100% comfortable with myself, but compare myself to how I am now compared to how I was then, you know, I do recognise that I can do some things well, and I am self-confident. So those two things sprang to mind.
Yeah, sometimes it just takes someone to point out something as basic as that, to actually realise.
The common thing for me is that I need people to tell me how I'm feeling and behaving, because I clearly don't have a clue what's going on.
Well, you and me both. One other thing I've got kind of circled down as well, which I really need to touch upon, because it's something I've probably bored my family with to tears over the years. But that's music. And how important it is to me. And I'm sure you've probably heard me bang on about it as well. But the Bare Naked Ladies, which when I say it to people the first time, they go, what on earth is that? What on earth are you into? They're not something dodgy, I should clarify, for people who don't know. They are a band from Canada that I've been listening to since I was a kid. They've been around for about 30 years now. And obviously I was introduced to them by my dad, because he's Canadian. I suppose, a double hit wonder in this country, in that everyone will know One Week, the song, which is an American Pie, and they'll also know the theme tune for the Big Bang Theory TV show, which is also them. But when I was at my lowest, so my third year at uni, that coincided with their release of an album called Grinning Streak, which is kind of the most aptly named album I could have used in that time. And also on that album was a song called Odds Are. And the lyrics in the chorus are, the odds are that everything will be all right. And as simple as it sounds, that song and kind of their whole attitude to life, in that, yeah, things can be a bit crap here and there, but don't actually worry and try and have fun wherever you can. And I kind of latched onto that and took their entire message and persona on board. So every song that they've got that's remotely like that, I'd latch onto. They've got another one that's just came out this year called Looking Up, which is pretty much the exact same message. Don't worry about the things you can't control is a lyric in that song. So finding something like that to latch onto, as well as doing, you know, the accepting of yourself and pushing yourself to be into uncomfortable situations, is also something that's helped me a lot, and why that band will always mean a lot more to me than just being my favourite band.
Music is a difficult and a different one for me. So I've been involved with music as nearly as long as I have in sports. I first started playing the piano age, I think it was seven. I can play four instruments. One of my main releases at uni, actually, as well as doing my cheerleading, was being able to go to jams once a week and just play music that I love playing. And that's the time I think I've probably ever in my life come across as the most self-confident, is when I play jazz, because I just have such a passion for playing. I'm not necessarily different, but I love playing it, and I love soloing. Like, I love being the centre of attention and, you know, everyone looking at me and I'm doing this really cool solo, and that's just really out of character for me. But I remember doing a gig, and a couple of my uni friends who have been absolute rocks for me, they came to watch, and they just said, I was grinning ear to ear the whole time I was playing, and this is a good hour and a half set, and my jaw was cramping afterwards because I'd been playing what I thought was really hard, but obviously I'd been smiling. And so that was my release at uni, and things were bad, you know. I'd either go to the cheer session or I'd have a jazz session, and, you know, just be able to just play music I love playing and release. But when things were really bad, I actually struggled to listen to music, because it allowed me to drift off into my own thoughts and made the bad thoughts come back, and, you know, it was it would get me down. And there was a period of time actually during first year at uni where I just couldn't listen to music full stop, which is bad when you consider that a cheer routine is based entirely on music. But then I guess in that situation I could sort of quantify it and be okay with it. But yeah, walking around town, I'd have to listen to the radio. TalkSport was my main go-to channel, and I've probably not said it out loud before, but I've certainly thought of it. In some way, TalkSport stopped me from doing something to myself that I probably shouldn't have, and I probably would have massively regretted and hurt a lot of people. Because being able to listen to, you know, just people just blabbering on about whatever on the radio is actually really therapeutic, because it distracted me and reminded me that, you know, no matter how I was feeling. I mean, this was all subconscious as well. I wasn't intentionally doing it. But looking back, you know, realising that other things were going on in the world, so that, you know, TalkSport, they bang on about football all the time. And, you know, but that for me was brilliant, because I could just listen to other people moaning about, you know, something really trivial, and it would distract me and take me away from it, whereas music would not distract me. I wouldn't actually be able to listen to the song because my thoughts would take over. Mm-hmm. You know, the music would just be just a way of shutting out the rest of the world, and then my thoughts would overpower it, and it would be horrible. But music has also been fantastic for me as well, as I mentioned earlier with cricket. It's been the one effective technique of me listening to music before I go out to bat, and that calms me down. Strangely enough, I'm really into sort of my heavy metal, my sort of really heavy sort of screamo stuff. And part of that is because I just love, you know, the drums, and, you know, the rhythms and the guitars, and that I think is great. There's also the energy it provides. So I used to get so hyped up before cricket, and I couldn't find a way of dissipating this energy. And once we actually tried drinking like a Red Bull or a cheaper version of, which initially seemed to work, but not for very long, I got very aggressive. And then we realised, actually, let's try listening to music. And I'd listen to these really heavy, upbeat songs that actually would just dissipate some of my anxiety, and I'd be more relaxed. And this is probably not how it should work at all, but for me it does, and I'm slightly stranger than that. And then I'd be less nervous and have slightly less energy, but I'd go out there and I'd bat better, and I'd take the time and the rational thought process. And even now, when I'm in, you know, a bad mood, the two things I like to do and combine them, I like to go to the gym and listen to really heavy music, and I just like to, you know, have a really good session on the weight or have a really poor session and just, you know, use that and the energy of the music to just dissipate all the frustration and tension. I come out and I'm actually feel bloody good because I've worked hard, I listen to my music, I've got rid of all this energy and frustration and anger, and very cathartic. So I have a really weird relationship with music in that it's been a hindrance and a help.
Yeah, it's a strange one in that it's obviously very subjective and people like different things, but I think the key is to try and find a message to latch onto, which is kind of what I found with the message that Ben Ekeles were trying to send and the lyrics of those songs as well. Also, I really wish you told me about the TalkSport thing when I still worked there, but we'll gloss over that.
Well, actually, one of the people I listened to a lot was Colin Murray,
who's not there anymore.
I worked with the other week, but I didn't tell him about it.
In time. And I suppose we'll wrap this up. Since we're a sports podcast and everything, and we'll talk about the sport aspect of our recovery as well, and something that you've obviously alluded to, but also something that kind of struck me as well, because obviously when I first met you, when we were on our NCTJ training course, mm-hmm. and you'd messed your leg up, and you were in and out of rehab, and I wonder now, obviously knowing you a lot better than when I first met you, how tough was it having to deal with that rehab aspect and not being able to do sport, and how much has the sport aspect kind of helped you as well?
So that knee injury I'm still rehabbing with now, nearly 2 years after I did it. But this was a really, I mean, this literally happened 2 weeks after I graduated and left my third and difficult final year at university. And in a way, it's sort of what I needed, because it was just a distraction of the failed relationship, which, you know, had been hanging around for various reasons. And I just need to get away from it, and it's actually just provided almost the perfect distraction from it, which is really weird. Like I was saying, it's actually the easiest to deal with, even though it's been going on for nearly 2 years. I've not once really been in a dark place about it. I think partly because I've been here before and I know how to deal with it, and also because now I know that there is so much less pressure on me, on myself, because I always wanted to play professional sport, and now, you know, that's sort of, for the moment, gone to one side, partly because of my age. Although there might be something exciting in the pipeline, but I won't share any more on that.
Oh, jeez.
That might be a no-go, we'll see. But yes, the injuries were difficult. As a school kid, you know, all I wanted to do was play sport, and I became known as someone who would get injured. So yeah, I started with my hip injury, which I was out for 9 months, and it was, you know, misdiagnosis or being accused of faking it. It was all very difficult. And then that sort of set a precedent. And because I've got this genetic condition, you know, my joints are weak, so I have to do, you know, a lot of work now in the gym to build them up. But then I went to university and, you know, I spoke about how lonely and isolated I could feel in cricket, but actually, you know, Chile was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. It was the first time I felt part of a team. You know, I felt valued and respected. you know, everyone in the team wanted you there and you wanted to be there and, you know, you wanted them there, and it was so much a love relationship between everyone. And in my first year, cheer was again, like with TalkSport and like with playing jazz, it was another positive in my life that I really clung on to, because I got to go to sessions, I got to go be with mates, I got to forget about everything, you know, doing really cool stuff. And learning catching people is really cool and hard work. And also, you can't afford to be, you know, I couldn't afford to throw tantrums every time something went wrong, because, you know, you're dealing with other people, you know, other people are relying on you, you've got to be switched on and focused. So in my first year, that was brilliant. And then in my second year, which was my best year at university, is when I made some of my closest friends for life at cheer, you know, joining the uni squad, you know, competing, winning my first ever title. You know, I'd never won a sporting competition until I was nearly 20 years old. And that was just incredible. And then on, I think, 3 or 4 in that year, which was fantastic. And then I met the two people through university cheer who then got me help. But then in third year, cheer became a hindrance because the individual I'd had the sort of intensive relationship with was on the same squad. That made things awkward. I had some really bad, nasty incidents at cheer. So when I thought they'd broken my neck was actually the final nasty incident. There'd been a few other back spasms and stress fracture in my foot and other things going on like that before then. And cheer stopped becoming fun for most of that year on the university level because, you know, I wanted to be there, but it just wasn't living up to what it had been before. But fortunately, I was also coaching my college team, and that, for me, was just incredible. You know, coaching a bunch of first and second years who were just, wonderful. And then, you know, I keep in contact with a handful of them now, and it's incredible, you know, to see how they're doing. And again, it was like a family. I was almost like the father or the grandfather figure. And I call them my cheer babies. I know it's really crass, but that's what they were to me. They were like sort of my mini family. And again, I felt accepted and wanted. And then my final ever cheer performance at uni was with them on the lawn, you know, at the back of Trev's on a sunny day. It was an incredible experience. And, you know, I ended up being flown. You know, I was wearing a woman cropped up. I was just having fun, having a laugh. I felt really, really good about myself. And that was the perfect note to end my cheer career on at university. I've since joined the new squad, and again, it's just incredible. It's different because I'm with half a squad of adults and half a squad of young kids, but, you know, the kids are fantastic, really, really talented athletes. And the adults, we get on so well. Some of the conversations we have are incredibly rude, but it's just nice to, you know, again, feel wanted, feel part of a team. And yeah, cheer is, I know everyone still finds it a bit weird and a bit unique, but for me, you know, things would have been a hell of a lot worse without cheer. I honestly couldn't say, you know, would I be in as good a place as I am now without cheer? Probably not. You know, it's been incredible for so many reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it may be unique, it may be niche, but it's that camaraderie and finding a place where you fit in that's the biggest thing. It's exactly the same thing I said about fencing as well. Without fencing, I don't know, or rather without those fencing people, I don't know where I'd probably be without them. And I know I haven't fenced since I left university, and I have been thinking about it starting it up again soon. And it's fresh in my memory because the weekend just gone, obviously that was the first fencing competition I'd done since at university, but that was with all my old university friends, so I knew it was going to be fun. And part of my apprehension of finding another club and getting started again is that I'm slightly worried that I won't find that same sort of club feel. But in time, I suppose, I may sort of take the dive, if you like, and see what my local club here actually has to offer. But I'm also interested, you obviously mentioned the talk sport aspect and also your proneness to injuries as well. And I'm going to say this to slightly big ourselves up, in that by doing this pod, talking about sport and we may not be TalkSport or BBC level just yet, but give us time. Does that kind of help you as well in that, because your injuries may have hindered you doing sport, and you have this sort of this, sometimes it's going perfectly for you and sometimes it's not going perfectly for you, but does having this outlet where you can just sit down and talk sport, does that actually help you?
It's just nice, you know, to be able to sit down with a really close mate and chat about things we're passionate about and have a debate, and, you know, be able to, it's also really a really nice feeling to be able to have such a, to be able to talk to such caliber of guests. I mean, I'm in awe whenever I go into my office and, you know, I'm surrounded by professional hockey players, you know, Olympians, Olympic champions. And it sounds pathetic, but, you know, I bumped into one girl, Catherine Lane, in the gym the other day, and I spent like 10 minutes actually building up the confidence just going over to her and have a chat. And I know her and I've chatted to her before. I don't know why, what was wrong with me, but it was actually such a confidence boost to chat to her just like a normal human being. And that's something I get when we do these interviews, and, you know, some of the best interviews I've done, you know, Kay Wilson, Sammy Kinghorn, Sally Conway, Shona, Giselle, you know, they've all afterwards, you know, come away and said it was lovely to chat to you, you know, wish you all the best. You know, they still keep an eye on us on social media, they still tweet us and everything. And that's such a really positive confidence booster for me to think that actually, you know, I can mix it with these, you know, elite athletes. And actually, you know, they can have some form of respect for me. And then it's just nice to be able to, as I said, you know, chat with a good mate in you and just talk about, you know, Russia and drugs. it's just a good distraction, and it's fun.
Yeah, exactly.
You need fun things in your life.
Yeah, good thing we started it up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I didn't mean for the end of this to kind of turn into a self-promotion advert, but that is kind of the same way I feel. Like, partly my phone book looks very snazzy now, with some of the content.
Oh yeah, mine's incredible.
Likewise, but also, yeah, just the feeling of sitting down with someone who's done such amazing things in their sport and building that camaraderie with them in one way or another is such a rewarding thing. And obviously, there's a large list of guests we've got now. Too many to kind of go through all of them individually, but I just look at this last couple of weeks, and we've been putting these mental health specials together, and talking to Ruth, talking to Chloe, talking to Sarah, talking to Sophia, and it's just building that rapport with someone that you just get because they've been through similar sort of stuff as you, and they appreciate you and your questions because they know you've been through the same sort of stuff as them. May not be exactly the same, it may not be exactly the same conditions, but we can understand how complex the brain is and how weird it is when it tries and dictates all these other thoughts to ourselves. It's just a really strange, complex thing, but it's always nice to find someone to connect with in that way.
It certainly is.
And with that, because I've just looked at the timer... We had better
wrap up. This is going to be a really long episode, though. You've got a lot of editing to do.
We had better wrap up this final episode of the Mental Health Awareness Week specials, because that's it. That's us done for this. And we hope everyone kind of picked up something useful from the episodes that we've done so far, be it just an interesting, insightful listen, or if anyone's actually found some advice out there from any of our guests and from ourselves as well. That was kind of the entire point of us putting them together in the first place, so we hope they've done all right and done some good out there.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, listening to the episodes that have been aired as we speak, it's just been incredible. You know, there's been honesty and there's been, you know, thought-provoking insight into the life of an elite athlete from sharing as they've been, you know, Sarah Williams picking up all her stuff. You know, you've had Ruth and Sophia, you know, have been so open and honest. And, you know, I think that's only going to help people, you know, if people can relate to them and, you know, see how they struggled and see how, you know, they've managed to overcome, you know, some incredibly tough times. Hopefully, if, like this, at the start of this, if it helps, if we can help just one person across this week, then I feel like we've done a good job.
Exactly. But yeah, we'll wrap up that episode, and we'll be back at some point. I'm sure we'll tweet it and Facebook it when we're next back, when we will actually talk normal sport.
Let's talk Russian drugs.
That's not Russian drugs, although I fear with a Russian World Cup coming soon, there will be some Russia chat at some point later down the line. But yeah, thanks for the heartwarming chat. I feel like we've connected on the air more than we ever have done before.
Well, I mean, I like to feel we connect most of the time, but yeah, it's been good. It's been cathartic.
Exactly. So yeah, thank you so much.